Welcome everyone to the Apocalary Podcast. I'm Steve Hees.
Dr. Van Beek.
We'll take Dr. Van Beek. Yeah, that has a nice ring to it. It's pleasing, rolls off the lips. You know, it's quite pleasing. Lair, we're gonna kind of like we did last week, where we picked a topic and just talked about it. This week we're gonna do the same thing, right? We're gonna talk about dispensationalism. So introduce us to dispensationalism and kind of what is it? I mean, we've heard about it lots in our series when we went through the Book of Revelation, but maybe give us a primer on it.
Okay. Well, the reason that we're doing this, Steve, is that because when we talked about the second coming last week, one of our listeners or our listener asked me to explain dispensationalism because it came up a number of times. And you're right, it does come up when you're dealing with the Book of Revelation. Dispensationalism itself is a very important part of American evangelicalism in their interpretation of scriptures. It's been super popular. It's been almost the view of American evangelicals probably for the last century. Okay. It began in the mid-1800s by a guy named Darby.
Okay.
Not Darby and the little people from Irish lore, but a guy named Darby. I want to say John Darby, and then I just couldn't remember if it was John, but I think it was John Darby. And he came up with this idea of dispensationalism. Now, dispensationalists will say that the concept of dispensationalism can go back to Irenaeus and others, and it predates Darby.
Okay.
But he's the guy that we usually go back to. And then we say it became very popular in America through the Brethren Church, and then through other all the other groups picked it up as well. Hmm. Your background, Steve, would have had dispensationalism in some of it. My Pentecostal background has dispensationalism in it. The school that I went to in the United States, if you weren't a dispensational pre-trib rapture, if you didn't believe in that, you couldn't hold papers. So it became very, very important. The question, of course, then is, what is it? You know, what is dispensationalism? The word dispensation just means period of time. And the dispensationalists, what they did is they said there were seven periods of time that God dealt with humanity, and they take it beyond period of time. A guy named Ryrie said it was a distinguishable economy in the outworking of God's purpose, or it's different periods of the way God stewardship on the earth, God's stewardship upon mankind.
Okay.
And different ways that God dealt with man, right, throughout history. And we know that, don't we? We know that there was the Moses law was a specific way that God dealt with Israel and with all of humanity through Israel.
Right.
And then the church was another period after Moses law. Jesus died on the cross and he said, I came to replace this or to fulfill this, and the Book of Hebrews deals with that so strongly, right?
Right.
So these are dispensations. We say Adam and Eve. That was a period of time that God dealt with the earth. So the dispensationalists, they usually have seven periods of time that God deals with mankind on the earth. And it starts with innocence, which is Genesis 1-3, and that's Adam and Eve before they sin.
Right. Okay.
And then there's a failure there, and then there's the promise of Christ, the proto-evangelium is this promise of Christ after that.
Okay.
Then there's the period of conscience, because of course that's what they got from Satan was this conscience. They knew that they were naked. and conscience goes Genesis 3-8. So that's from the first sin in the garden, and them getting kicked out of the garden to Noah's flood.
Okay.
And there's actually a Noahide law that happens. The Noahide law is mentioned in the Book of Acts. That's don't eat blood, stuff sacrificed. The main thing was to do with animals in their own blood and don't cook stuff in its mother's milk and things like that. These are part of the whole Noahide thing. Well, after Noah, then we have civil government, right? Okay. And that's flood. That's the flood to the Tower of Babel.
Okay. Okay.
Or Babel. Do you say Babel or Babel?
I go with Babel.
Well, let's go with Babel. And then after that is the time of the promise, which is from Abraham. So then of course, after that, you've got Abraham. And God makes his promise to Abraham. Abraham leaves Ur of the Chaldees, you know, and Ur means fire, take another right. fire. Right. And he goes to the promised land. And from Abraham to Moses is this period of promise. So God's dealing with Abraham and Abraham's offspring and the promises to Abraham. And then once you get to Moses, you have the law, right? And the law is the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. And this is the whole period from Moses all the way to Jesus is this period of law. And now some will break this down and they'll say this starts at the coming of Jesus. And some will say that it's at the cross, but most put it at the cross. There's that little bit of a flux period, right, when Jesus is on the earth.
Right, right, right.
And that's a period of grace. So from the cross to the rapture, they will say, is the period of grace. And then after that, you have the millennial kingdom. And then after that, you might have something, you know, Satan has to be released for a little while. So.
Right.
So that might give you a little more. So these are seven periods of time that God dealt with humanity, right? The dispensationalists then of course the concentration for eschatology, for study of the last time, the concentration is on the last 7 years of Revelation.
Okay.
So dispensationalists are futurists. When they look at the book of Revelation, they'll see those last 7 years being future to whatever period of time the author happens to be writing. So Walvoord, who is actually a very good scholar, saw future to his time. Ryrie's another one. Schofield is another one. Okay. And they would have all seen these periods of time. And now the biggest thing about dispensationalism is not so much that God had different purposes at different times, but is their take on God's relationship with mankind, and specifically with his relationship on Israel, on Abraham's offspring, and his relationship to the church. Now, if you're ever looking into dispensationalism, you're going to find that they will talk about covenant theology.
Okay.
And that's the other side of this thing is covenant theology. Covenant theology said that God had two covenants with mankind. The first was law, and the second was grace.
Okay.
Yeah, law and grace. And then they would sometimes say there was a third covenant of redemption, which covers the whole thing, right? Okay. The redemption goes through the whole thing. He dealt with mankind in a law way and then later on in grace. Now, grace can go back into the Old Testament. There was some grace when he dealt with Abraham. There was some grace when he dealt with David. The main part of this grace was pointing towards Jesus.
Yeah.
And I think if you ever talk to a Lutheran, for a Lutheran, everything is law and grace. That might be unfair to some Lutherans, but that's sort of the way they see it, right?
But it was all law before.
Yeah. As we generalize all the time.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when we talk to each other. But the biggest thing about dispensationalism is when they talk about the future, this is the part that's important to us, right? Because of our dealing with Revelation, is that when they talk about the future, they see that there was a promise to Israel, and that there was a promise to the church, and they were very separate promises. So everything to Israel has to do with Israel. Everything with the church has to do with the church. There's not the overlap that the rest of us see. They don't see the church as being an outcome of Israel, like covenant theology would see the church as being an outcome of Israel. This is now spiritual Israel, right?
Right.
You know, the vine, the grafting of the vine.
Yeah.
The breaking down of the dividing wall, journey theology in Acts. There's all of these different ways that they look at it. And in Revelation, we would say that they use Jewish language to talk about the church. And but the dispensationalists will say no to that. They will say no. There's a promise to the church and there's a promise to Israel. And they're not completely wrong. There's times when Paul talks about the time of the Gentiles being finished. There's times when he talks about Israel in very strong terms, as if there's a promise very specifically to Israel.
Right.
But most of us will see the church being tied into that promise.
Okay.
Dispensationalists won't.
Okay.
So that's kind of what they are all about. And it's important to know it, because this is a very strong part of American theology. When I say American, I mean North American theology, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe even down into Mexico a little bit. I don't
know. But like you said,
that's what they did with the wall, huh?
Yeah. Well, like you said, yeah. If you can get it, throw it over the fence. but you know, like Canadians are obviously highly affected by American evangelicalism, right? I mean, we almost are a direct reflection of it.
Well, yeah. With the coming of TV, you know, and even with radio, but particularly with the coming of TV. Dispensationalism just became super popular, and they had a number of different people on TV, like, you know, obviously that espoused this kind of a doctrine,
right.
And very, very few. It wasn't until probably into the 2000s that anybody started on television started talking about anything other than dispensational theology.
Interesting.
Anything other than this 7-year period in Revelation and the coming of the Antichrist and all of that. That was really strong on television.
Okay. Well, Lair, would dispensationalists be? Would you consider them literalists? You know, are they typically more literal about as they step through Revelation, or are they? Can they be just as figurative as the rest of the gang?
I think they are complete literalists. Like, remember when we mentioned that when the grass was burned up in Revelation, and then later on it said, don't harm the grass. They would have, you know, very much say, well, grass can grow back. You know, they wouldn't see any kind of, even Walvoord went as close to a figurative interpretation when he talks about the blood to the horses' bridles in Revelation 14. Remember when it goes for 1,600 stadia?
Right.
That the blood rose to the horses' bridles for 1,600 stadia. We said 1,600 stadia is the length of Palestine. It's about 180 miles. And for blood to flow that high, I mean, you know, remember we said you'd pretty much have to slit everybody's throat over a culvert to get going that much blood. And what Walvoord would say then, he said, probably what they referred to is it spattering to the horses' bridles, and that's as close to figurative as they would be comfortable with.
Now,
the interesting thing is that scholarship in Canada, in many places, has gone away from dispensationalism. Like the popular media is still very much looking at Revelation in the 7 years with a pre-trib rapture. Maybe even a mid-trib. I don't think they'd ever get to post-trib, but a mid-trib rapture. But they would see this kind of stuff. But the scholars kind of moved away from it a little bit. we do need to remember that it was, we talk about fundamentalists and fundamentalist dispensationalism. Those terms kind of come together a little bit. And what these guys did for us, though, is their view, their literal view, kind of fought against German historical criticism. And a lot of us have accepted bits of German, you know, redaction criticism. But these guys fought against it, and they fought for the literal interpretation of the Bible. And in some ways there is value in that, because evangelicals in general will still accept that the Bible is the book that we need to read. And they'll accept that what we read in the Bible is true, right? They won't see a lot of errors in the Bible. We espouse a thing called verbal plenary inspiration, that every word in the entire original writings of the Bible was inspired of God. Well, it was the dispensationalists that held on to this view for us. We may have floated along, and some of my friends that are scholars in some of the schools down, even in the United States, they've moved away from this in the past few years, and some of the movement has scared me a little bit,
mm-hmm.
because, Because once you start getting completely symbolic with everything that happens in Scripture and you deny historical truth, like that you say that, that historical accuracy isn't important, it, it kind of opens the doors to anything. And And I never thought it would go too far for me, but it has, actually.
Yeah, yet here we are.
I'm sort of symbolic, right? I believe that you read literature. You know, if it's poetry, you read it as poetry. You know, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Well, everybody knows God's not a shepherd and we're not actual sheep, right? So I say, well, you need to read literature the way it's intended. But then when they start saying, well, the book of Acts, it doesn't matter if those stories are true. You know, I'm like, oh, man, it does matter to me a little bit.
Yeah. Well, it's different if you'd look at maybe the story of Jonah as a figurative story, or Job, you know, which are two that I've heard of commonly referenced as, you know, these are allegories to kind of explain the nature of God, as where you say the second coming is figurative, or, you know, Peter, you know, the Holy Spirit touching 3,000 at Pentecost there or something like that, right? So
yeah, or the ages of the guys in Genesis when they were 900 years old, or you know, Methuselah was 900 and something years old. And they say, well, that's not possible. You know, people just don't live that long. And for me, I'm still okay with it. I'm still okay with them being really old guys. I'm still okay with Jesus, you know, making a whole bunch of fish for everybody, you know, fish and chips for the whole gang, you know.
Yeah.
No Guinness, but fish and chips. So. Yeah. So, and I'm still okay with it. And actually, I'm okay with Jonah being swallowed by a great big fish.
Yeah.
You know, and Pinocchio too. You know, I don't think Pinocchio is real.
I did not see the Pinocchio coming. I thought I'd see it coming. I didn't see it coming. So, well, and I remember you even said that about the fighting fundies, right? You know, I think that's what you called them, that we needed them around to hold on to that high view of Scripture rather than this low view of Scripture that was starting to emerge around the turn of the century. So,
yeah, that's right. And so the dispensationalists have actually been very important to us. And even though I'm symbolic in my interpretation of Revelation, and I'm kind of preterist, you know, I'm quite literal about the second coming,
right?
You know, and I'm even okay with a literal millennium, and that. And people would say, "Well, that doesn't fit." So, yeah, it doesn't.
Okay.
Yeah.
And your point is,
I don't know what to do with it, right?
Yeah.
But I know that that in seminary, in the past decade or two decades, there has been this movement away from dispensationalism, and even the view that these people are foolish and that they actually, they put their grit on the Bible and they won't deviate from that. Mm. But if you start listening to them, no, these are some good scholars.
Yeah.
They're just taking a different stance than the one that I've taken. I can't see it the way that they're seeing it, but I can still appreciate the scholarship that's coming out of it. We can disagree and still be scholars, right?
Right, right. And the end result still gets us back to a risen Christ coming for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and where as I said, we're very literal about Jesus returning for us.
Yeah.
And it's just important to me that people understand dispensationalism. And look, Steve, we're talking for 15 or 20 minutes on this. And if you want to listen to a guy, you can go on, and there's a guy named Lewis Johnson. I think he's from Dallas Theological Seminary. And he has 6 one-hour sessions on dispensationalism. And he gets way, way deeper into this, you know, than we ever could in this little bit of time.
Yeah.
But and some of what he says is very good. Some of it, I think, might confuse the average person, like me.
No. You're not the average. It's okay. But no, like you said, right? I mean, at its most, taken to its nth degree, is probably very difficult to understand. So,
well, and even dispensationalists don't agree with each other on the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And which is good, right? Because because you know, as Christians, we're not going to agree with each other on all this stuff. And they don't agree on what a dispensation is. They don't all agree on how many dispensations there are, you know. Where they tend to agree is that the promises to Israel and the promises to the church are separate, and that the end times are a very specific period of time.
Right.
And everything that happens in the book of Revelation is literal. And they tend to agree on that. They may disagree on when the rapture happens, but they do agree that there's a rapture.
Okay.
So there's these kind of things that happen. And as we go through Revelation, Steve, you know, we're agreeing with each other on some of it, and some of it we're not, because you're not as smart as me, and so you obviously don't agree with me on some of it.
Once again, we're happy it's not an audio pod or a video podcast.
I still need you to help me with my computer, you know.
Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're very welcome. Yeah.
Well.
I'm almost embarrassed that I even went that way.
Well, fine. Since you decided to be hurtful. So, Larry, maybe one last question before we close off. You mentioned, I think, kind of a salient point where you said there's kind of this divergence between popular culture within the church. And maybe I'll ask you this question twofold. You know, is that popular culture in the pastors, or is it popular culture with just the congregants? And then the scholars on the other side. And is that gap widening? Is it continuing to widen? Will there ever be this meeting? Is the scholars going to be pulling... You know, what's your sense of how is that going? Is it kind of losing favor, and these other views, the preterist views, are they starting to kind of come into the church and be more accepted?
I think if you did it by the commentaries that you read, you'd find that that the futurist commentaries are still the most popular ones. Preterist futurists, of course, are the most popular, because they see stuff applying to the first century on Revelation, because they see stuff applying to the first century church and stuff being in our future still. And I don't know if that was people trying to pull away from their dispensational roots and just dragging some of them along with them, or if it was just actually where these people were at in their heads. Scholars live on the edge. Mm-hmm. That's their joy. That's the right. The life of a scholar is to question the status quo, and so the scholars will always be kind of leading on the leading edge, even a little beyond the leading edge, and the pastors have to live a little bit into the scholarship, but they're also administrators. They've got to live in the world that their congregation is in, right? And they can't go too far ahead of their congregation, or they'll just lose them all. So I think the scholars will always be doing stuff out there, and congregations will slowly follow along. Okay. Very, very much like we always say, you know, the church is doing what the rest of the world did 15 years ago. Mm. You know, if you give a 15-year time lapse, the church seems to follow along. When I was at first a pastor, the church said that divorce was wrong, and we were all taught that divorce was wrong. And now they still kind of say it's wrong, but a Pentecostal pastor is allowed to marry a divorced person.
Mm, okay.
But a minister couldn't marry a divorced person and still be a minister. But now I think they can. So I mean, things, you know, I know we hate the word evolution in the church, but these things do evolve. And I think this whole idea of dispensationalism, There's always going to be strongholds of it, and I don't know if the church in general is going to move away or not. And we may move away and then come back, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Remember what everything I say about the rapture. If there is one, I still want to be there. And just ahead of you, Steve. Just
as is our professional way over the years of. I just want $1 more than Morris.
and it was actually you who said that, and not me.
You liar! You liar!
No, they said, "What do you want, Steve?" And you said $1 more than Van Beek.
I don't. Okay. Anyway.
which I thought was hurtful because, you know, over the years you've done so much better.
Larry, that was awesome. That was an awesome, awesome discussion of it. Yeah. Folks, I hope that was enlightening to you. Like for me, that was helpful for even for me to deepen my understanding of dispensationalism. I'm not sure I'm even, you know, I was raised in a dispensationalist denomination. And kind of wandered off into other areas. So it was kind of good to be reacquainted with that and rethink through some of those things and why they got there, you know, what they were trying to do with it. Ironically, they ended up at seven periods, eh? I wonder if that's because it's the perfect number.
Forget, hyper-dispensationalists have nine periods of time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and moderates have five periods of time. Yeah,
but that's...
I do apologize for saying I'm smarter than you, Steve. You're going to hurt me for that. You did the last time I said something like this. You hurt me afterwards.
No, it's completely true. You are completely. trust me. I've risen to my level of incompetence in my station in life. So, but folks, I hope that was enlightening to you. We sure appreciate you listening to it. If you have comments, again, you can always comment. Go back to our blog and you can actually make comments on this episode. And if not, if you're just completely happy, just tell your friends, tell everyone, make posters and put them on telephone poles. That's what I tell everybody.
Pictures of what you think we look like.
Yeah. Well, actually, come to think of it, don't do that. but anyway, thanks so much for coming along with us on this journey. We sure appreciate you having along. And until next time, I'm Steve. He's
Larry.
And we'll talk to you next time on the Apocalyptic Podcast.